Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, my name is Jero, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. This is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. There may be some here who are not familiar with our tradition of personal anonymity at the public level. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the levels of press, radio, and films. Thus, we respectfully ask that AA speakers and AA members not be photographed, videotaped, or identified by full name on audio tapes and in published or broadcast reports of our meetings, including those reports on the internet. The assurance of anonymity is essential in our efforts to help other problem drinkers who may wish to share our recovery program with us. And our tradition of anonymity reminds us, that AA principles come before personalities. A further note about anonymity. Out of respect for others, please do not take photographs or video during any of the meetings at IKIPA. Also, be considerate when taking photographs or video inside and outside of the hotel. Thanks, man.
Getting done is the most important thing.
That's true. Also, be considerate when taking photographs or video inside and outside of the hotel. Take care that you do not capture images of AA members, family members, and friends who did not give permission and may not wish to appear in your pictures or videos. Please do not post recognizable photos or videos of identifiable AA members on websites accessible to the public, including unrestricted pages on social networking sites. Okay, we've invited three people to share their experience, strength, and hope on the topic of time management for service junkies. Our panelists will be Kyle from San Diego, Brian from New York, and Tina from Waukesha, Wisconsin? Cool. There we go. Then we'll start with Kyle.
My name is Kyle. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really... I think we have a winner. I'm really grateful to be sober today, and I'm really grateful to be here in New York. I thought it was really funny when they asked me to do this panel, because to be honest with you, there was no time management. My time was based solely off of the conference we were going to host. Both times I got fortunate enough to host the conference. And, you know, I don't think I jumped into this. I guess I could tell a little bit more about myself before. I don't know. And I always get stuck on that. And then all of a sudden, I have 5 minutes left and it's time to get sober. You know, I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona. I live out, like you said, I live out in Oceanside, San Diego. I've been there for 11 years. I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona for the first 16. And just my mom and, you know, and my little brother came along when I was 9. And I don't know, it was kind of normal, you know, like I did the DARE thing, swore I would never do all those things, and then what I really learned was DARE introduced me to those things, and, you know, now I had ideas, and my neighbor was always trying to, you know, entice me, and finally one day I said, okay, and, you know, and it was normal for a couple years. I can't say it was normal, like normal kids, I don't think they end up in jail at 13 from roaming around their neighborhood, you know, like going through, rummaging through cars, and their mother's saying, no, I'm not going to pick him up. I would think that if I was normal, my mother would say, oh, my God, yeah, I'll come pick him up, my poor baby, you know. And I would have never maybe drank again for a couple of years, but that wasn't the case. I went to jail at least, you know, 5 times before I hit 18. And you know, and psych words, and I don't know, just I want to be in there. And I really wanted to call the program's chair when I figured out that they were going to be voting while I was going to be in here and say, I just kidding. But it's not about me. So I moved to California when I was 16. My mom had moved there before me, and I didn't want to move because I didn't think I could find drugs out in California. Yeah. And so I moved to California finally because my uncle kicked me out because we got in a drunken fight with each other. And so I moved out there and began the same things I was doing, and I got the same results. I'll fast forward. I was on the streets for a couple of years. My mom just lost patience with me, and I was on the streets from 18 to 21, and I eventually started getting to a lot heavier stuff. And then I ended up in jail that one last time, and then everyone said, oh, you're gonna go right to the drugs when you get out, and I was adamant that was a problem, and I wasn't gonna do that, but alcohol wasn't a problem. And when I got out, I had a couple beers, and it was fine. And then the next morning, I saw some old friends, and next thing I'm gonna know, I'm sleeping in an abandoned building, still haven't seen my mother, and had 11 beers, and then I didn't get drunk. And I was 90 days sober, and I didn't get drunk. And I still don't understand that to this day. I have a hard concept of the concept of God I hear in AA meetings. I don't relate to most of it, you know. But I can always take myself back to that moment that, like, I cannot comprehend why 11 beers didn't get me drunk at 90 days sober. Well, like, you know, a day sober, but 90 days before that, like, not drinking. And, so with that, that's my mustard seed. I flopped around in AA for the first couple months until I met her. And then 2 weeks later, she said, okay, it's time for you to go. And I got really miserable really quick, and someone encouraged me to try the 12 steps. And that's what I did, diligently. So it's hard sometimes for me to hear people talk about, like, you know, managing other people's lives, newcomers, you know, relationships and whatnot, because that saved my life. You know, it got me miserable real quick, and I did the steps. It was my only option left. I mean, I could have drank, that's an option, but that just wasn't my story. And I've been very lucky for that, and blessed. I don't know. We didn't even have a young people's committee in my area. We had, like, Greater San Diego, which is cool. They're now bidding on IKIPA, and that was far for us. And then we had Orange County, and that was far for us. And we were tired of going up to all those things. And so a couple guys, some of my buddies, started this committee, and everyone, in, you know, I don't know. Some of the people in North County were like, "But there's already one down in San Diego," and they were frowned upon. So it was controversial for a while, right? And it was funny, but. You know, we started off as a service committee, and we started going to our area, and we started doing all this, and at the time, I didn't know what the heck any of these conferences were. I had gone to the local roundup, and I was really bored there. You know, I went to the dance, I went to the meeting, but I was just really bored, and I'd rather, like, go run around downtown, or, you know, and just, I don't know what I was doing, you know, but... Someone brought me my first IKIPA 3 months before IKIPA LA, and I didn't sleep, and I just drank rock stars and smoked cigarettes and got really sick, and I didn't eat, and it was horrible, you know, it was horrible. And so, but something, I got something, I don't even remember who spoke or whatever, but, I know my buddy Pat spoke, I know that, I just remember feeling so incredible that everyone was there sober, and I couldn't go to sleep because I felt like I was going to miss something, you know? And so Sunday morning when Sacramento was awarded the conference from LA, LA is all outside standing around each other Sunday morning crying that their year's gone and that this beautiful experience for them, you know, it was, here it is. And I wanted that. You know what I mean? Like, I knew that was a high, and I want that high. You know, because like I had done the steps and I had gotten the results, and but I kind of like reached a wall and I was like, okay, what is this? You know, and so I joined the North San Diego Young People's Committee, and well, I was already on it, but I just was useless. But actually, what it was is a buddy of mine said, you should come up to our IKIPA business meeting in Los Angeles. And I said, okay. And I started driving. I started driving every week or every 2 weeks to Los Angeles from San Diego to go to the business meeting. And I became the volunteers chair. And so I was calling up the whole entire country, like all the time. Chances are I probably called some of you asking you to volunteer at IKIPA, you know? And through doing that, like I got to know a lot of the committees that have now hosted, you know, like I know a lot of people in Oklahoma, Atlanta, and New York because I was calling them saying, you know, do you want to be of service? And of course they were going to be of service, you know, because that's who they were. And like I ran up my phone bill and I had to up my minutes to unlimited. And there's been multiple times me being of service, like it's like, all right, apparently it's time to up my minutes. Because I talk and talk and talk, and you know, I don't know. I've been able to have experiences that I can't even tell you. So I didn't really like want to go to work all that much, you know. I really wanted to just like do that, and I really wanted to just go out of town and like, you know, any. I think at the time I had hurt my back, and so I wasn't able to go to work, and I was on disability, and the outreach chair. I was really good friends with the outreach chair, and he just kept saying, "Jump in the car." And so we would just go everywhere, you know, and no sleep. We would hit four events in one weekend, and we'd just go everywhere. And like for a while, someone was calling me. A bunch of people were calling. Wow, going to San Francisco next year. Sorry, but I lost my train of thought. So after IKIPA was over, like that was an incredible experience, and you know, I didn't sleep at all then, but I ate a lot of food, and I got like 2 hours here and there, but I didn't get sick, and it was a phenomenal experience, and you know, and once again I wanted more of that, and so I went back to my Young People's Committee that I was on in San Diego, and got full head into bidding on our state conference, IKIPA. You know, and there was times that like, I don't know, that I kind of stepped back because I was, my work's not always so steady, and, you know, and people would like frown upon that and say I wasn't doing my job, and I would just like tell it pretty much them to screw off that, you know, and I was doing the best I could, and you know, like I haven't always done everything right, but I've never like left anyone hanging, you know, and I've never, I don't know, this AA deal, this gift, it means a lot to me, and I've second guessed it a lot, you know, and so 3 years later we got that conference, and I became the events chair, and I remember when we went into elections, they said, you know, hey, don't have any preconceived notions of what you know, just be available for everything. And I was like, no, I have to be events chair. You know, and like I was not, you know, and our programs chair had to be programs chair. Like that's who we were. So it was intense because it went to the hat, and it was excruciating. Against the guy that like I hated at the time, and now we're best friends, which is great. That doesn't always happen in AA, but it did for me. So it was humbling, and you know, and like, oh my gosh, I was so obsessed over this. Like I'm surprised my girlfriend didn't leave me. You know, like this is supposed to be about time management. I have poor time management. You know, my girlfriend says I'm completely obsessed. If I told her that if IKIPA ever comes back to San Diego or comes to San Diego and I told her that I was going to join, she would probably like look at me all cockeyed. She's like, no, you're not. You know, and because like I don't know, like there's been times in my sobriety that I've thought that AA was more important than my family. You know, that like that I had to go to AA. I was like this martyr, you know, that I had to go to AA or I couldn't hang out with you guys, my family, you know. And there came a time in my life where I realized that that wasn't the case anymore, and that maybe it wasn't ever the case. It just maybe I was scared of how to interact with my family that was drinking. And that it is what it is, and I'm not judging anyone, but, you know, and, I don't know, I obsessed over my commitment that whole entire time, and it went off great, and I owe it all to my volunteers, basically, you know, because I just kind of sat back and watched it all happen, I kind of have a lesser role today in WIPA and in service. Well, not really. I got voted onto their advisory council for California, and we'll see how that goes. And I'm really excited about it because I've heard some of my dear friends say they've had profound spiritual experiences being in that room, you know, because we have closed deliberations on Mike Ikipa. And so I look forward to that because I look forward to the next phase of my development. I really do. And, you know, I kind of stepped back from AA after this conference in February. I really questioned a lot of the people around me and questioned a lot of the rhetoric and what I believe as dogma. You know, Southern California, I'm sure there's other places in the country that are maybe similar, but there's some things in Southern California that are very like rehab-esque. And a very, like, a lot of people give their opinions in AA in the meetings that aren't in the book, and I don't agree with that, and that's just who I am, and that's how I was brought up in AA. And so, you know, there came, like, the bubble popped where I realized, like, I can't sit in these meetings any longer, and when I disagree, you know, when I'm like, this isn't in the book, and I'm not going to tell this new guy to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, even if my sponsor told me to do that, it doesn't say in the book. I can merely suggest it, of course. You know, and I'm not going to tell him about his sexual life, and I'm not going to tell him about, you know, like, I'm not a doctor, I'm not any of this. And so I kind of stepped back for a while, and me and my sponsor talked about it for a while, and he said, you know, maybe you should try some different meetings. And actually what he said is, I'd rather you go to no meetings than the meetings you're going to, because I was going to a lot of young people's meetings, and you know, that just is what it is, and like, I love being here. I'm sick of hearing that, but I love being here. You know, it was funny, like, as we're outreaching all over the country, our conference, by the time we got to our conference, I was so sick and tired of hearing the bunches. Oh, I was like, I'm going to sit up on stage and they're going to do this to me. Oh, this is horrible. But, I love the enthusiasm. I now that's my high. You know, I like to see the new people like running around crazy and then watch them crash and just laugh and go, I was there, you know, and then watch them a couple years later and they're like kind of more a little adjusted, you know, and I don't know, you know, I my life is definitely a lot more balanced right now because I don't really believe that I need to be in 4 meetings a week, you know. I believe that I need to I believe that there's not meetings in some areas of the country. And that I'm very fortunate in Southern California. And you guys are very fortunate here in New York City. I know that because I've been to meetings here. And I've been to meetings in LA where there's 3,000 meetings a week. And I hear some people sometimes say, you know, like, these meetings are great and they keep me sober. And I'm like, no, it's the book and it's the spiritual connection that you need to find. And I hope that it's through one drunk talking to another that you can find that. But, and that's really what I've been focusing on lately is talking outside of the meetings with people that I respect and trust and I guess admire. You know, and paying attention to my now fiance and paying attention to my family and trying to, I don't know, like, because of AA, I got to be there and make an amends to my grandfather right before he passed away. And I don't know how I'd be able, like, my uncle beats himself up because he didn't make that amends before he passed away. And I told him that it is what it is. Like, maybe he passed away because you both are now sober, you know, because everyone that needs to be is sober, members of Alcoholics Anonymous in my family. And then all of a sudden my grandfather passes away after the last one gets a year. I thought that was interesting. Cause he didn't have to worry anymore. So I don't know, I'm going to go out to Phoenix next, next week for my family reunion, and I might not hit a meeting. And I used to be afraid of that, though. You know, I used to be afraid of that. I gotta hit a meeting, gotta go hit a meeting. And I have people there. I have a fellowship in Phoenix. I've been to many meetings there, but I know that I don't have to. And I don't know why I'm saying that. This is the first time I've spoke at a meeting after I've kind of had this experience the last 4 or so months. That's just where I'm at. And like, I don't want to leave AA. I don't always relate in AA, but I know that I still relate in AA. And I know that AA is not the only thing that gets people sober. You know what I mean? But it got me sober and it's still working. So I'm going to stay. I don't know. I guess I could say that I have more balance today than I did 2 months ago. And I have more balance, you know, today than I definitely did like a year ago when I was obsessing over the conference we were going to host that I really had no power of screwing up anyway, you know, because I would sit there and be like, I just constantly obsessed over like this person was going to screw it up. And like, because I had this idea of what I thought it was supposed to be like based off of what I had seen. And that's not what it's about, you know. It's about a group conscience and it's about God speaking through that group conscience. And I know that today, and I don't know, I'm forever grateful, and I'm excited to hear the other two stories, so thank you.
Thank you. Our next speaker will be Brian.
Hey, Brian.
My name is Brian. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Brian.
It's nice to be here. My sponsor asked me before the meeting, "Are you nervous?" I said, "Not at all." And then about 5 minutes before he finished, my heart started jumping out of my chest. So let's get the yeah. Thank you. That's all I ever wanted in AA was some sympathy. So and from a woman too. So there, just got both. Thank you. yeah. My sobriety date is August 1st of 1993. I got sober when I was 19. Ironically, this is the very first ICKYPA I've ever attended. And as also as irony would have it, my home group here is in New York City, the New Garden Group on 31st Street, between 6 and 7. We meet there at Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday at 6 p.m. So if any of you are left over, we have a meeting tomorrow and I would love to have you. But as irony would have it, the last time ICKYPA was here in New York City was the weekend of my last bender, and it was about 40 blocks from here. And I had been coming to some meetings, been brought to AA meetings by a guy who, I use the word loosely, 12-stepped me. He got sober when he was 16. He was about 5 years sober when I met him, and he was far more dangerous sober than he was drunk. And he'll tell you the same thing. I met him one night on a Thursday night at this club that I used to go to in New Jersey where I grew up, and I was liquored up on whiskey as I usually was that Thursday night, and some frat guy from the local college was hitting on my girlfriend, and I went off on like a Tommy from Goodfellas fit on this guy in the middle of the club, looking up at him, and I'm going to kill him and his six friends and tell him to come back here next week and, you know, and threaten everybody in the club and so forth, and standing next to me that night was this guy. And we hit it off, you know, he was crazy like me, and we used to go vandalize houses, and then he'd take me to a meeting, you know, and we'd, you know, and I was still drinking, and he was sober, he was without a drink, and so forth, but I had been to meetings, I got brought to AA meetings when I was about 18 years old, and I remember there was a clubhouse I used to go to in Princeton, New Jersey, and they had a dance there every Saturday night. I met a lot of people, like NA kids and AA kids and so forth, and I was on the train. I had had a surgery and picked up a prescription painkiller addiction on the way. I didn't realize that it happened at the time. They were doctor prescribed. So I'm not a social Percocet user, by the way. But I was on the train and I ran into all these guys that I knew from that club going to ICKYPA. And what I didn't know is I was on my way to my last bender. I didn't know I hadn't had a drink in 3 or 4 months or 5 months. And, you know, and I'm a prime example of that. You know, you can put the drink down and turn into like a rabid squirrel. You know, I was out of my gourd and it was the worst 5 months of my life in those times. I didn't, had no program whatsoever. I was sort of floating around AA meetings, no sponsor, and scared to death because I was scared. And I ran into these guys, and that night I picked up a drink. And they were all happy. They were on their way to ICKYPA. I didn't even know what ICKYPA was, you know. And And I went on a pretty wicked bull's blood wine and prescription painkiller binge and came crawling back to AA. And so that's why it's kind of a privilege to be here. It's just funny to me. And I'll be honest with you, I've never been involved with young people's meetings ever in my experience in AA. And I have all the respect for young people's meetings, but I just went to meetings, you know, and I'm one of these young people that came to meetings, and there was, fortunately for me, a lot of young people were living in the area that I was in, but I didn't relate to young people. I mean, it was one of these people, like, I understand, like, young people come into meetings and they see these old guys and they don't relate. I came in and saw old guys, I'm like, cool, all right, there we go. And maybe that's why my hair went gray so young, but, you know. I just went to meetings, and to be honest with you, I just fell in love with the love that was in the rooms. And I was so flippin' broken when I got here, and suicidal. And I just wanted to die. And it was the first person that said to me, "Hey kid, welcome. The coffee's in the kitchen." Like, I thought I was gonna burst into tears, you know, because I, like a lot of people, you know, just thought I was a worthless piece of crap, and that, like, everything that I had done or anything that I had thought, you know, I mean, I just did not deserve the love in these rooms, you know. And I had always believed that there was a God, but I didn't believe that God wanted anything to do with me. I had every belief that, you know, God's grace was for you, but not for me, you know. And if that's not ego, I don't know what it is. But I didn't know that at the time. That was the reality that I walked in here with, you know. And I started drinking at a very young age. I come from an alcoholic family. I had my first drink around the age of 3. It was Fleischmann's whiskey. My father was a shot and a beer guy, and I can remember grabbing that shot glass right around 3 years old when walking by his little TV tray. And it wasn't really because I had a hard day at the sandbox or anything. I just, you know, I just was, like, attracted to alcohol. And I came, you know, from a family of drinkers, you know, and I drank all throughout my childhood. I was always drinking. And the neighborhood that I grew up in, you know, I spent a lot of my childhood, to be honest with you. My mother had to go back to work when I was, like, in kindergarten or whatever, and I used to get babysat by my stern Irish grandmother down the block from us. And, you know, I spent most of my childhood, like, you know, lying on my grandfather's bed upstairs waiting for my father to pick me up, watching his black and white TV, like watching old McHale's Navy episodes and stuff, you know, and being alone, you know. And I got to tell you something, it set up a pattern. We're all out, you know, isolators as alcoholics, but that, I brought that long into adulthood, that kind of thing of just being by myself, checking out mentally and so forth. And I've done it in sobriety too, you know. But when I discovered, you know, I grew up in a pretty bad neighborhood. I grew up in Trenton, New Jersey, and if anybody's familiar with Trenton, well, there's no reason to go there, really, unless you're going to renew your license or buy some drugs, you know. I used to describe, like, Trenton was like, you know, Sopranos meets the show Good Times kind of thing, you know, and it was like, you know, it was a fairly bad area kind of thing, and, you know, and I was not, that's not who I was, you know what I mean? I was a very small kid. I actually sprouted to this size in high school, if you can believe that, you know. And I thought God had a sick sense of humor putting me in that neighborhood, you know. And it was like, you know, breeding ground for my alcoholic paranoia, always looking over my shoulder, and just was a lot of violence, a lot of, like, you know, a lot of knucklehead stuff growing up. And I was just like, I don't know what I'm doing here. Like, obviously, don't fit into this equation, you know. But I tried to fit into that equation. So by the time I got into AA, I didn't know who I was, what I was. I had a lot of attitude that I didn't even know was mine, you know, and I couldn't stop drinking, and I couldn't stop taking pills, and I just wanted to die, you know, and by the time I got here, to me a good night out drinking was a bottle of Reuniti wine, and a room at the Sandman Truck Stop Motel in Bordentown, New Jersey. Like, to me, that was a phenomenal night out. You know what I mean? And one of the reasons why I'm here, I really think Reuniti is a good wine, if you're familiar with it. And if you start with Screwtop Wine, there's really many places to go beyond that, you know. I'm not a glamorous drinker. You know, I am not a glamorous individual when I'm drinking. I'm a pig when I drink, and I'm really an animal when I drink, and I don't care who's in front of me, who's around me. I use people, you know, I lie to people. And most of the time I don't even know I'm lying. And then I turn around, I get called on, and I'm wondering why everyone's like, you know, what's everyone's problem, you know? And I was a vandal. I was a thief. I was a failed gangster. I tried to hijack a truck one time at work, and went into a panic attack, and that didn't really, It's a true story, unfortunately. That kind of ended my gangster career, and I never lived it down with the guys I was working with, because they had set it all up and stuff. And yeah, anyway, so I don't know how to hijack a truck. So there, but why I say that is because that's just like, you know, I was just trying to figure out where the hell I fit into this whole equation, you know, and, you know, and I had this guy that started bringing me to meetings when I was like 18 years old and so forth. And I'll tell you something, the isolator that I was, you know, I'm going to cut to the chase. Like, you know, fast forward a number of years, I finally got involved. I got relationships right away. I started, like, went away to school. I quit school. You know, I got a girlfriend. She was 5 minutes sober. I was like 10 minutes sober, you know, and we like fell in love, you know, and I did everything wrong. I did everything wrong when I got here, you know, no sponsor, no nothing, you know, and I finally got into enough pain, like this gentleman was saying, you know, to start working steps and so forth. But I'll be honest with you, you know, I went a long period of time in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm a firm believer that, you know, you can stay sober physically, you know, for long periods of time and still isolate and still, I mean, if I'm, you're looking at one. You know, I'd gotten a sponsor and I started sponsoring people. We went through the book and all this kind of stuff. And the truth was, I got a head full of Big Book and I really started talking the talk a lot, you know, and I used that as a shield against people to really still get to know me. I'd get up at the podium, you know, and I'd rock the mic, you know what I mean? And I'd, you know, do the whole thing. And the truth was, I was never speaking from the heart, and I never did for about 10, 11 years in AA, you know, and I was doing service and I, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And I had like, you know, the t-shirt of the good AA kind of thing. But the truth was that, you know, I am exactly what that fear, my favorite fear acronym is frantic effort to appear recovered, you know, and that is the story of my recovery, you know. And I would be at meetings and stuff, like, I can't tell you how many times I'd have waves of fear of being a fraud, that I knew this book inside and out, and I talked the talk and kind of thing, but there was just not a, you know, I wasn't like living it. I wasn't like, you know, speaking from the heart and so forth, and was always withholding a few pieces of change, if you will, you know, fast forward, I was at the International Convention in Toronto, and I was like about a month away from a crash, and I didn't know it, you know, and I was completely like having that old school feeling of like looking through the glass wall at everybody and the emptiness, and I'm on the other side, and I was like, something's wrong here, I'm almost 12 years old, there's something fundamentally wrong. I didn't know what it was, though. As irony have it, I went out to Wisconsin, Milwaukee, for an internship. My ego called it a job, but it was an internship, I was 31 years old. I crashed. I absolutely crashed. It was a financial bottom. I was on food stamps. So I was making about $50 a week. And I was just spiritually and emotionally bottomed out, you know, and I got a new sponsor out there. And fast forward about that, that began the resurrection of my connection out, or I should say the beginning of my real connection to Alcoholics Anonymous out there. And I had to be 800 miles away from New York City, to finally be new. Because my ego would not allow me to be new. And if there's anybody new in the room today, I just want to tell you, if you have time and you're in pain right now and you feel like I can't ask for help, knock it off. Just knock it off. Because I almost died in AA because of that, you know. But anyway, so I fast forward, I got this resurrection, I got this sponsor and so forth, and I made it back to New York after the year I was out there. And my new AA life began, and I was going to the same meetings, but for some reason was looking through a new pair of glasses, as they say, and I got involved in service in a way I never did before, and I made the mistake, I do some bookkeeping and stuff like that too, and I made the mistake, I was the intergroup rep, in my home group, and I made the mistake of telling the manager there something about accounting software, and next thing you know, I'm like the treasurer of like the steering committee or something like that, which is not a job I wanted to do. It was a 2-year commitment, and I've never had a 2-year relationship, let alone a 2-year AA commitment, you know. And the truth of the matter was, I didn't want to do the job. I did not want to do it. My ego was telling me, I don't know how to do this. Bookkeeper, I don't know how to do this. I'm not qualified, blah, 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 blah. And I called my sponsor, gave him all the reasons, and thought he was going to agree, and he said, you need to do this, you know, and so then I did it, you know, and it was fantastic. And I never felt so connected to AA as a whole after having that experience, you know. And why this ties into this topic for me is that, you know, I'm a firm believer that I need to do service because I am, being an isolator and having spent as much time alone as I am, guess who I think about all the time, you know, and I'm still infected with that today. That has not gone away, you know, to be honest with you. What happens is that gets treated on a daily basis by doing service and working with that, with other alcoholics, you know, because as soon as I stop doing that, I become my favorite subject again, you know. And that's when fear creeps back in and all that stuff. But anyway, I was doing this commitment and it was changing my life. And then I got voted in to be overall group chair of my home group in Newburgh. So I had these dual commitments going on kind of thing. And it was great. And I felt completely, I've never been so connected to AA. I was, the loneliness vanished, all this kind of stuff. But I guess where this ties into the balance thing is that, you know, I'm a firm believer to be service, but you don't have to do every service position. You know, and that's the other thing too, because there's a fine line between my needing to be of service and where my ego starts to kick in. Because the reason I say that is I had another year left of that treasurer's commitment, and I was here at our host committee meeting, and I was figured, let me get involved in ICKYPA. I've never done this before, and I was about to put my name in to be the treasurer of the whole ICKYPA thing, and I remember thinking to myself, like, yeah, I'm all jazzed up, I'm going to go do this, and then the thought of the schedule of what I've already was already involved, and then this, I started to get a lot of anxiety just sitting there in the chair because it was a lot. I was sponsoring about 11 guys at that time. You know, I had this going on and so forth, and I was about to stand, and I realized it was one of my biggest lessons as far as like this whole balance thing is concerned is that the only reason why I wanted to do the ICKYPA treasurer position was the ego of saying I'm the treasurer of ICKYPA. And I'm just being honest with you. You know, I had a lot on my plate. I had a lot on my plate, you know what I mean? And I can't be a service hog either, because there's other alcoholics out there that are willing to do this stuff. And if no one's willing to do this, sometimes I've got to be willing to drop that and let that thing go undone until someone wakes up and steps up to do it. You know, like, don't complain that the coffee's not being made. Why don't you make it? You know, don't complain that no one's going to intergroup and be a rep. Go be the rep. Well, I don't know how to do it. Well, I didn't know how to do it either until I started doing it, you know? So I don't know anything, you know, so there's a balance to all that too, you know, and I also have to learn to play, because I've also hidden out in like keeping myself busy and so forth too, where I've been so service, so sponsee, so this, so that, and work and blah, 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 blah. And then I'm like this like wound up tense guy, you know what I mean? And there's, you know, again, the balance thing. So there was that. So I was about to stand up to do this, and somebody from my home group gently tugged on my shirt and said, why don't you sit down? You know, you have another year of this other commitment. They're going to be fine without you. You know, and I was like, okay. You know, and it was like this fit of sanity went over me. And I thought to myself, you know, my sponsor probably would have shot me if I did this thing. You know, and I called him up. I said, I was going to go do this. I'd have shot you is what he said. I'm like, there you go. So what I'm saying is that, you know, it is imperative that I'm of service constantly in AA, but at the same time, you know, I got sober to have a life as well. You know, and it sounds contradictory, but it's not, you know. I mean, so there's plenty of opportunities out there. There's a lot of people in this room. You know, there's a lot more people in there in AA than there are service commitments. That doesn't mean I have to do six at the same time, you know. So I don't even know how long I spoke, but I'm done. Thanks.
Thank you, and our last speaker will be Tina.
Hey, Tina. Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Tina. Hello. Are you guys service junkies? Yeah, baby. All my little sickos in here. God, you guys are sick, sick, sick. I really thought I'd come here, and there'd be like two people in here. Well, and us. But let me give you a little bit about me. My sobriety date is April 19th, 1984. I have 26 years of sobriety. I'm 41 years old. I came in when I was 14. I'm a freak. Isn't that crazy? So my home group is The Well. We enjoy Living Life Big Book Meeting in Waukesha, Wisconsin. It rocks! Thank you, all my supporters are here, because that's how we roll from Wisconsin, don't we? Right on. I love service. I'm a service freaking geek. I used to call myself a nerd, and then I got into a fight with this guy, and he was like, you're not a nerd. I'm like, yes, I am. I'm a total service nerd. He's like, no, you're not. I'm like, yes, I am. You should never fight with old timers. And he goes, so you're a Northeast regional delegate? No, I'm not. I'm a geek. Okay, so now I'm a geek. No more nerd. I got it. It's a total, complete honor and a privilege to be up here with you guys. ICKYPA is amazing, and to be asked to speak. Hi, guys. My husband just walked in. And to be asked to speak, I absolutely believe that this is an honor and a privilege to be up behind this podium. Hence why I'm wearing a dress whenever I come up to a podium. I truly believe in the honor of respect. It's in my sponsorship chain, and that's what we do throughout our sponsorship. So anyway, so I just want you to know, I come from this little town called Germantown in Wisconsin, and I live next to a park called Spazland. Yeah, that was kind of the story of my life. I was a little Hicktown girl that had a bad attitude and a bad mouth. And I got sober young, and because of that, I think my attitude was that they needed to do for me. You know, that kind of attitude. And I was the kind of girl that would go to a meeting and I would drag the chair across the floor, or I would, if somebody was talking and I didn't like them, I'd be like, you know, and just try to, I don't know, just try to disrupt them. I was a little, yeah, I was a brat, total brat. I would call myself something else, but I'm a total brat. And I didn't really get along with the old timers. I didn't want them telling me what to do, and I wasn't about to do anything. And my very first service commitment that I ever did, and I really didn't commit to doing it, I just started doing it, was I was about 6 months sober, and I started cleaning out the ashtrays. Do you remember those tin-colored ashtrays? They had all different colors, and I started cleaning them out. And, of course, I couldn't just clean them out, right? No, I had to clean them out and then tell you how much I cleaned them out and how good it was. And I was, like, the best ashtray washer ever, and I remember this old timer turning and looking at me and going, "It's about time you do something around here, Tina." And I thought, "What a jerk!" Whatever. And so my sobriety was like white knuckled the first four plus years. In fact, I became very homicidal. I wanted to kill everyone, and I was a rager. And I don't know if there's any ragers, but man, I was angry. And I really felt cheated. I felt cheated in life. I felt cheated by you. And those old timers were just jerk offs, and they just didn't understand. They were just old farts that had bad clothing, and I just wasn't going to have it. And some old guy, John C., actually, I came back just a broken mess from that. And if you're in the grips of alcoholism and you're dry, you will understand truly the miracle of this program, because I was out there dry thinking that not drinking was my problem. If I could just stop drinking for a little while, just let me get my head clear. I'm young. I just need a little fun, you know, right? I just need to be loved. I just need a boyfriend. I just need a good job with lots of money, right? That's all I needed. And that wasn't happening. I was stealing. I was living like a pig. And I was trying to get one-night stands to fill some holes. And I was doing all the wrong things. And thank God, you know, that these old-timers, like, they're so smart. Aren't they smart? They look at you and they're like, "Keep coming back." And I'm like, "And all right, fine." And those old timers basically swooped me up and started to get me busy. And thank God, because I don't know about you, I'm a type A personality. Like, I like to multitask. Like, let's get going, people. Come on, you know. And I think they saw that in me. And I went to this place called the Monday Night Action Group in Menominee Falls. And a guy named John C. said, "Tina, we really need you. You know how they trick you? Did you ever have an old timer trick you into doing something service work?" Yeah, or they sign you up and then they tell you about it. It's not nice. But this old guy tricks me. He's like, "We really need you." And I thought, "You need me?" Well, of course you do. You guys are old. You don't know what's going on, right? So, yeah, so I was like, "I'm going to teach you a thing or two." And I sit down at this business meeting. And it was one of those district meetings or something like that. And this guy had a title, and I thought, I'm going to get to know him. He has a title. He must be important. I had no idea that that a district committee meeting was like the least liked thing in AA. I had no idea. I was thinking I was really cool, you know, like, wow, they invited me to this. And I know that guy. I swear to God. So that was kind of the beginning of my service. Like, it was all about ego. And basically, what I started to find out is that this was kind of an inside job. And when I was absolutely crushed and broken when I got back here the second time, I needed to make some changes. And see, I was mysterious. I wasn't going to go to no home group. I wasn't going to do what you were all doing. I'm special. You just don't understand. I'm young. Oh, God, it was ridiculous. So basically, my sponsor was like, "Sit down, shut up, and you're going to have a home group. And my service commitment started truly, I think, from that moment on. I did what they call, became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous at my home group. It was the craziest transition I think I've ever gone through. Not only did I have to be there a half an hour early, I needed to stay late. I needed to reach my hand out to women only. Direction of my sponsor. She was so picky. And, I needed to actually volunteer for things at that home group. And not only volunteer, but actually follow them all the way through. And I don't know about you, but I was a fabulous starter. I was always the kind of person that, like, wanted to do, like, a model kit or whatever, you know, and you're going to put it together or do something fun. And, of course, I didn't have enough glue, so I would be like, I need glue. Like, I would totally hitchhike somewhere to go get glue, you know. I didn't drive a whole lot when I was younger, but and I would do whatever it took to get that thing done, you know, that compulsive, obsessive kind of thing. But if anything went wrong, I'd be like, oh, I didn't want to do that anyway. And I'd leave it. Did you ever do that? I did it all the time. See, I didn't know anything about following through on a commitment. I had no idea that it would give me integrity. I had no idea that it would give me respectability. I had no idea that it would actually treat my core being as a spiritual warrior that I am, that it would start to make this girl that had all these holes complete. I had no idea. See, I thought that cleaning up chairs was degrading. I thought you guys needed to do that for me. See, I had no comprehension walking into a meeting that somebody came early, they set up all these chairs, they went and made coffee, and some people even fold napkins, or maybe they made a special dessert. I had no comprehension of that at all. See, I come from a place called MSU, making stuff up. I walk into a room, I think everybody's talking about me because it's all about Tina, 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 Tina. That's what happens to a girl like me. And what happened is I got a job at my home group, and I suited up and showed up, and I did it. And it's weird when you do that, because did you ever have that old-timer that you're really scared of? And you really don't want to know anything about them, but you kind of eavesdrop. You do that little ear hustling thing, like, what did they just say, you know? And you really want to find out, but you don't want to find out, you know? And there were a couple of old-timers that just really scared me, and I would go and do whatever it is that I needed to do, and I would hear them say things like, did you see Tina? She's actually doing her commitment. And I'd be like, yeah. And it made me feel good, you know. I was like, oh, I was a tough girl. You can't tell me, you know. And I would hear him say things like that. And little by little, I started to feel good, you know, like I belonged. And then, well, then I was the best, like, chair setter-upper there ever was. Like, don't even mess with me. But then you're supposed to move on, right? And I'm like, well, yeah, but they're not doing it right. And they're like, yeah, but we need you to do this. Well, then I wanted to do everything. And it was quickly pointed out to me about the traditions. And one of our traditions, Tradition 5, which is one of my favorites, it says something, I'm going to paraphrase, something to the effect of, Tina, it's better if you do one thing really well than to get your little sticky fingers in everything and do them poorly. See, because I don't know about you, but I'm ego-driven, so I kind of like to do everything all at one time. Once I start feeling good, I want it all, right? I want more. And that doesn't necessarily turn out to be good for you guys if I'm doing commitments for you guys. So I started to learn pretty quickly that you need to make sure that you're paying attention to what you're actually doing. I was about eight years into this home group, and these are the principles I started to believe in. And if we're a program of principles, you better have some, or you're just going to believe whatever you want. And some of the principles that I believed in was that you better do one thing really well than to do many poorly. And at that home group, they decided to have some people that needed to be on the steering committee. They had to be the secretary. I mean, this one person had to be on four different things. And, you know, I'm a believer that I'm an example no matter what. Either I'm a good example for you to follow, or I'm a bad example, and you should never do that. Now, the bad example is definitely impactive on my life. There's no doubt about it. It's not the better of the two. It's just more impactive on my life. And I saw some people that were taking on a lot of commitments, and to me, it felt like they were stealing. They're stealing a position for somebody else to get that position. And like Brian said, figure it out for themselves. See, I was stealing the dignity, and I was watching people get the dignity stolen from them because somebody thought that they could do it all. And I don't believe in those principles. See, I believe that I'm here to do one thing really well. Now, that's not to say that I'm not going to do a multitude of different things. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is that when I have a big commitment, I stick to that big commitment. I don't start taking on all these different commitments like Brian was talking about, like that his sponsor would have shot him. I would have shot you too. That's stealing. I would have. That's an ego-driven thing as far as I'm concerned, and that's what they told me, and that's what I believe in. So, anyway, needless to say, I started to become active. Actually, in 1993, I came to the conference here in New York. I had never been to the Windy City, and I was just excited and scared and freaked out, and I had never seen so many young people like this. And sorry, not the Windy City, that's Chicago. The Big Apple. And I was just freaked out, and we put a bid in, and we didn't get it, but they told us to start a young people's conference in Wisconsin, and we attacked that thing and went after it. And I also served on another committee, and I thought, wow, I socially am an inept person. I don't know how to socialize with young people. I didn't know how to hang out with young people. I was a young person who got sober in early days, and then all of a sudden, the 80s and 90s, like early 90s, these treatment centers started having all these rehab things going on, and all these young people kind of flooded AA, and I thought, you are in my AA. Do not mess this up, right? And so I was already past the stage of being naughty. Like, my chair-dragging days were over and kicking them and throwing, and I was very naughty. I won't get into all that. But I was kind of over that, and they weren't. They were coming in doing that. And I was like, don't you mess with my AA. So I couldn't. I was having a hard time connecting. And what happened is I started this thing with Glurkypaw. And that line in the book where it says, where people normally wouldn't mix. We were a group of people who would not normally mix, right? And I fought with somebody. He's here today. I just think that's so cool that I'm up here talking about service junkie and time management, and he is a guy that we had like and then became friends. And what an awesome experience, all due to service work. But I started in 1992. I went to this thing called Glurkypaw, and I sat down at this meeting with young people, and there was a guy there that was leading that meeting, and he led it to such a degree that I thought, I want to lead a meeting like that someday. I want to help the young people understand and get organized and get into this rhythm that they can go out there and do this conference and make it anything they want and have any kind of thing that they want go on there so that it would feed whatever struggling there, you know, whatever struggles are happening in the younger community. I thought that is what I want to be involved with. That is so cool. I wanted to be a part of that. And I'll tell you, I am a part of that. I embraced the young people, and in 1990, I had gone to my first young people's meeting, and I embraced it, and I did service work the very first time I was there. They asked me to help with security, and I have suited up and showed up since that time. I'm there to serve. That's it. So just a little fast forward. So about time management, right? So there's a lot that goes with this whole AA thing. I mean, you've got sponsees. You got to call your sponsor. You got to hit your home. There's a lot, don't you think? I mean, there's a lot. And then on top of that, there's people that actually serve you all the time in your district, in your area, your GSRs. How many of you are GSRs? Right on. I love it. How about DCMs? Right on. Any delegates in here? Trustees? I know there's a couple trustees walking around this weekend. No? Okay. Inner group? Okay. I don't have an inner. Right on, sister. Inner group? Right on. How many of you pick up chairs? How many of you clean the floors when it's birthday month? Yeah, birthday month. When it's birthday month, you clean up or you set up. You keep humble. Put your hand down, George. Right? I mean, there's all different kinds of level of service. And I'll tell you, I've gotten to experience them all, and it keeps me humble. It keeps me really humble. I think the greatest service commitment that I've ever made in my entire life is greeting. When you walk into the doors of an AA meeting and people are scared and they've never been there, or maybe it's a large meeting. My home group is a large meeting and they are very loud and enthusiastic. The most important person is that person that's standing there that goes, hey, welcome, and gives you a hug or a good firm handshake and looks right at you and acknowledges you. I don't know about you, but I know that means something to me. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the service that I've just completed. In Toronto, I went to the First International in Toronto, and I was tricked into kind of going. I kept thinking, 60,000 old farts telling us what to do at an international. No way, not for me. And I went. Thank God I'm wrong all the time. I went, and I have a friend that's really service-orientated, and I'm like, how much more service-orientated can I be, right? I'm doing the deal. I got a lot to juggle. I got all these girls and blah, 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 blah. And I went there and I applied and I became a trusted servant for you guys as an ACM on the Trustees Board of Public Information. And I served at GSO this last 4 years. So for the last 4 years, I have been coming like a block away from here, serving you guys with the young people's video, with the television commercials, all this stuff, right? What an honor. Remember, I live next to Spazland Park. You guys, I am a loser and I'm on the board. Like, how does that happen? Well, I can tell you that, talk about time management. So, that's what I'm going to center on right now. I have all this stuff going on. I'm asked to share at different places. I've been in different countries, sharing my, experience, strength, and hope. And I have a calendar, not on my phone, because I can't take a quick glance at my phone and figure it out. I actually use a little hand calendar. So all the women that I sponsor have to use a little hand calendar. And what happens is when everybody asks me to do something, I say, well, you know what? I love that. Thank you so much. I'm honored, but I have to check my calendar. That's first. So this is how I do time management. The second thing that I do is I'm also a wife. I'm a pretty good wife. Hey, George? He's not even listening. Okay, so so I'm like the greatest wife in the world. And so anytime I'm about to take a commitment, I have to check it out at home. It's called unity of the house. You know those traditions that I had mentioned before is I have to bring them into my home. So I have to check it out with my husband. The third thing that I have to make sure of is that I have no other big commitments coming up. I have to be spiritually sound and ready to do whatever I was already committed to do. You get what I'm saying? You get what I'm going with this? So, okay, so that's kind of how I work that. Now, there are times in my life where there's these things called invaders. Those are sponsees, AA members, succulars that come off of you, right? Yeah, when you have Grand Central Station at your home, you have a lot of, yeah. And so you have to then all of a sudden find time to create those relationships that were talked about in our eighth step, right? In our eighth step in the 12 and 12, it talks about creating these unbelievable relationships. Well, if I'm so busy serving all of you, I'm not going to have time to be serving the ones that I need to be serving. I'm not going to be a great wife. I'm not going to be a great aunt. I'm not going to be a great granddaughter. I have to take time. So I have to schedule time for the people that I love, absolutely, positively. And I have to be very conscientious of things. So my husband's very forgiving. He's in AA, and I'm going to share this story with you because this is my experience, strength, and hope on time management and balance in my life. I was asked to share in Sudbury, Canada, my story at an old-timers function that was going on, and I was working pretty heavily at the time. I was about 17 days into travel, and I was only home for a day in between to see my husband. My husband was turning 50 years old. He is 50, fat, and fabulous. I love him. And, oh, yes, I do. And I felt we had talked and discussed that it would be okay for me to go. It would be a great opportunity for me to share in Sudbury where they don't have a lot of female, strong females, and they were looking for a female to come and speak. And we had talked about it, and he was going to be turning 50 the day I was going to be there sharing my story. Now, I don't know about you. I hate missing out on anything, you know? And I love the idea of something like that. Like, how cool is that? Until it comes up and it's time to pay up, right? And I was feeling pretty darn sorry for myself, and I thought, this is crap. And I do not want to go to Sudbury. I want to go home. And so all my home group, my homies, my sponsees, I had said I was very, you know, concerned. My husband was going to go and take a DJ show on the day that he was going to turn 50. And so they all decided to take cakes and balloons and surprise him and go and have a party. Well, the next thing you know, everybody's going and I'm not. And I'm like, what? I want to be at that party, right? So here's what happened for me. See, I have to outthink the box. Like, my balance has to come in different forms. It's not like what I thought it would be, right? I thought balance meant that, you know, every day would be perfect and lovely and you're, you know, just kind of going on this float. No. That's not my balance, you guys. My balance is that sometimes you get a little overworked and you have to get busy. So my husband's turning 50. I cannot forget that. That's a very special day. Is it not? It is. And I just told you I was a wonderful wife. So I had all these gifts prepared with cards for 7 days that I would be gone until I saw him. And I had somebody sneaking into the house and leaving these gifts with the cards. See, because I'm not only in service to you, but I'm in service to my husband. You get what I'm saying? Like, I have to do more when I'm busy like this. But I'm a firm believer that energy creates energy. And I'm not asking anybody to feel sorry for anybody. I'm just saying that when you want to get balance in your life, it doesn't come in a pretty picture. My balance came by I loved my husband. I showed him I loved him. I took time to think of him prior to it coming up. See, we're not great at that, are we? We're procrastinators. At least I am a lot of times. But as time starts to change, you have to start changing your thinking, and that's what I needed to do in order for me to fit other things in. See, balance isn't just about the whole I'm busy here and then I have to be nice over here. No. Sometimes it means that I have to kick it into overdrive. My grandmother is 92 years old, and every time you call her, I go, "Hi, Grandma, how you feeling?" She's like, "I'm blind." I'm like, "Yep, I remember." I don't want to take up too much more time. But my grandmother doesn't care about you like I do. She doesn't want to hear, "I couldn't come and see you, Graham, because I was in Mississippi." She is sick to death of me being in another state. She could care less. Every time I talk to her, she's like, "What state are you in?" You know, "Where are you?" She doesn't care. You know what she cares about? If I came to cut her grass. Oh, yeah, that's right. I am a great grass cutter and hedge trimmer. And that's what she cares about. She cares about me sitting in her living room eating candy out of that stupid candy dish that has like a mixture of wrong things in there and you don't really know what you're getting. That's what she cares about. See, she doesn't care that I'm out of town or that I had a sponsee in crisis and just delivered 2 babies. She does not care that I have a husband that just yelled at me. She don't care, but I have to. To me, balance is about making sure that my priorities are straight. My priorities are straight. Everything else falls into line. That's just the way it goes. Sometimes I'm really, really busy, and sometimes I'm not. And on the off times, I appreciate it, and I love it. You know what I'm saying? I love it. But for the most part, I'm pretty centered. I stay true to the traditions. I just got done with the ACM role, and I didn't deserve it. I didn't deserve to get to be a part of all that. And yet I did, you know, like I did the footwork. Service work is tangible to anybody who wants it. Whether it's in setting up chairs, greeting, like I'm going to do next week at my home group, or washing ashtrays, which we don't do anymore, or serving at the board, because those old farts need you guys at that board. So don't ever, ever be afraid. It'll all work out. Just keep the principles in mind. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.